Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.
This is Sound and Vision from KEXP in Seattle, and last week we started also broadcasting live in the San Francisco Bay Area at 92.7 FM. And with this new radio signal we've acquired in the Bay, I wanted to share an interview we did with the Bay Area artist and owner of the Tiny Telephone Recording Studio, John Vanderslice. He's transformed from indie rock analog purist to electronic experimentalist during his more than 20-year music career. He spoke with Jasmine Albertson about the making of his 2000 debut album called Mass Suicide Occult Figurines, as well as his most recent album, Crystals 3.0. They spoke last year about the jarring differences between the two records, as well as the massive changes in the music industry landscape since the turn of the millennium.
Let's go back to the year 2000 with Mass Suicide Occult Figurines. I'd love to know when the first seeds of that record appeared and what your life looked like back then.
Well, that record was entirely connected to building Tiny Telephone Recording, the recording studio that I've run since then. You know, that record was recorded as the kind of the guinea pig of Tiny Telephone in San Francisco. I mean, it was the first thing that was done there. It was the first, I mean, we, you know, basically my band at the time was like rehearsing there. We decided to convert it to a recording studio. So much of that record, and when I hear it now, I just hear it as like me figuring out the absolute basics of songwriting and recording. And to me, it was like a huge leap between the previous recordings I had made. And it was just about making a complete jump into the unknown. I mean, that was the year that I quit. I was working at Chez Panisse as a waiter and as a bartender, and I'd worked there. You know, that's a restaurant in Berkeley that I had worked at for 5 years. It was like a really famous California restaurant. They kind of like invented California cuisine. And at the end run, I'd been working in restaurants since I was like 15. So it was like a huge jump to leave this like amazing job that I had and kind of the end of being like in food service, which is a double-edged sword. You know, yeah. It's beautiful and amazing, but it's also, it's a difficult life. It's a difficult job and the schedule's rough. The pay is not that great. I mean, honestly, at Chez Panisse, it's a fascinating restaurant because it's kind of like a socialist empire, you know, like everyone basically makes the same wage, which is amazing. I mean, that's how it should be, you know. But you definitely take a pay cut to work there. So when I hear Mass Suicide Occult Figurines, it's really about me jumping into the unknown, starting a studio, quitting my job, really quitting the only way I'd made money since I was a kid, and going into music full time.
So I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the hoax started around the song Bill Gates Must Die. Yeah, where you claimed Microsoft threatened legal action for copyright infringement over the song, yeah. And it got you national media attention. Bill Gates must die. I have to know, was this a strategic plan or just an offhand joke you made did you expect it to get that kind of attention?
Well, the thing is that it was 100% strategic. You know, keep in mind that I had never, ever really gotten press before, and I was starting like a solo project. My goal in life was to be written up by the SF Weekly. Like, if I could get like one sentence in the SF Weekly that was like, you know, about Bill Gates sending a cease and desist letter, I would have been like overjoyed. So I sent in a fax that was like purported to be from Microsoft. And it honestly, it was so poorly done that I didn't think that anyone would fall for. You know what I mean? I thought that the story would be like that it's about the joke mm-hmm. of it. You know what I mean? The idea that Bill Gates is listening to indie rock music in 2000. that was kind of like the cornerstone of the prank, you know? And that he was like personally offended by this song by a completely unknown artist pre-streaming. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it was incredible how it just clicked with people somehow, you know? And I think that the song was like funny and like ridiculous. And the title is like, I mean, I was a troll, you know? And, and you know, it before long, there was like Wired was doing like hour long interviews with me. But then really quickly, I deeply regretted it because it's the wrong kind of attention. And you know, you're going to get busted. It became like dark at some point because I knew that there would be payback. There actually, honestly, wasn't payback, but I really thought there was going to be, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is funny because the song's not even really about Bill Gates.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it is, I don't know, I think it's interesting that the concept of like trolling in the year 2000, which like where you faxed something to journalists,
yes,
is pretty hilarious.
I know, it's so funny. And so, and also no one asked me if it was true. Do you know what I mean? Like
yeah.
No one point blank asked me is, did you make this up? The names were so obviously fabricated.
Teeny tiny little tins keep pouring out of my machine. I just typed a word and I just pressed return. Someone made this easy, made this inevitable. So for bringing me here, Bill Gates must die.
Let's jump to present day with Crystals 3.0. By now, you're a few years into making the big switch from full analog purism to electronic experimentations. But if we're looking solely at these two records and not at the evolution over the past 23 years, it's an incredibly massive departure. Like, it would be incredibly jarring if someone just listened to MSOF and then Crystals.
Yes, 100%. Yeah, they would be like, what is going on?
Right? What happened? So let's talk about the making of the album. It's only 19 minutes long, but it has so many layers. I'm curious how long it took to make this one and what all went into it.
Yeah, it took about a year, and it was like basically all of 2022. I just spent recording, I don't know, essentially fragments. In a way, I kind of got more interested in these like slivers of like of musical experiments, just like as you said, like, you know, a minute to a minute and a half long. I just started making all of these folders with like different pieces. And there was like a couple folders that had like noise experiments. And then a couple of them were like experimental songs. And then some of them were just like groovy experimental moods, essentially. And then slowly over that year of recording, I kind of clearly saw that I could make a 4-song EP, which I called Amethyst, and I put it out late last year. And then I saw that I could take like really what to me were the most successful of those experiments and then kind of like interstitially make the listener at least give the illusion that there's some kind of like through line. And it took a long time to layer dialogue. I put a lot of documentary dialogue and kind of sound effects on top to give it this kind of like, I don't know, buttery kind of like connectivity.
I don't understand what's going on. Come here.
I'm curious about the release process of this record now versus releasing your debut in regards to promoting the music and connecting with fans. Because now, being 23 years into making music under your name, do you feel like you still have to work to promote yourself?
Yeah, I've gotten so much lazier. It's crazy. I definitely spend a lot less time touring and a lot less time promoting stuff. And I'm just kind of, at this point, I'm kind of like, this is the most inspiring part of it. I mean, I think that touring especially just, I think this happens to most bands, it becomes like kind of unwholesome and maybe unhealthy at some point. You know, you really are disconnected from your relationship. You're disconnected from your friends. You're kind of living this fragmentary life that if you go over a certain number of weeks a year, it just really derails, you know, any continuity you have at home. So that's been like such an upgrade for me not to tour that much.
Do you think changes in the music industry, like streaming and social media, from your first album to now, how have they impacted your career?
It's hard for me to say if there was ever money in music. Do you know what I mean? I think it feels like maybe there wasn't ever money in music, but it feels like definitely show money like has been flat for what seems like 20 years. It feels like if you sold out like a 300 cap room 20 years ago, that you made really you netted the same amount of money that you do now, which is crazy, you know? So I think that like wages have been like very static in music, just like in most sectors, non-tech sectors of like the US. But I think that like streaming is like, you know, it's like good and bad. I mean, Spotify as a company is like toxic and really terrible. But there's something about having everyone have access to your catalog that's like kind of all I've ever wanted, you know? And like that is like a really beautiful thing.
That was John Vanderslice speaking with Jasmine Albertson.
Love. Small world. Alcohol. Big world. Too small.
That was Sound and Vision. And before you go, please subscribe to this podcast, rate it, and review it. Those little things really go a long way in helping spread the word that this podcast exists and is out there. And if you want to help financially support this podcast, again, KEXP is a non-commercial station, so we rely on listener support to do what we do. If you want to help financially support this show, please give a one-time $20 donation at kexp.org/sound. Thanks for listening.